I call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Burkle, have you looked at the minutes from yesterday?
I moved the minutes from yesterday.
Representative Burkle moves the minutes for February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2023. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Ayes have it. The motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Members, first up today, or just in general, we have a number of the smaller agencies presenting their budget. But we're going to start out with the Minnesota Zoo, one of the larger of the smaller agencies. And we have House File 462, Representative Bierman. I will move that House File 462 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And I think what we're going to do is just get the bill in the shape the author would like and then go to Mr. Frawley, and then we'll have some guests, some smaller guests appear. So, Representative Bierman also has the DE1 amendment. I will move the DE1 amendment. Representative Bierman, could you explain the change, the amendment, the changes the amendment makes?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't have that DE with me. Do you have a copy of it? Thank you. I'll come back.
Mr. Frawley. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So this request just adjusts to the governor's budget and brings the bill into the shape that I would like it in, please.
Any questions from members? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Bierman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 462 is the ongoing funding for the zoo's operational model with a budget focus on keeping any increases very low so that it continues to be accessible for all Minnesotans. And we have today with us the director, Mr. John Frawley, to present the information on the zoo's current plans. Thank you.
And Director Frawley, welcome. State your name for the record and maybe introduce our guests.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members, John Frawley, director of the Minnesota Zoo. Thank you, Rep. Bierman, for that introduction. And yes, Mr. Chairman, if it pleases you, we brought with us a staff member from the Minnesota Zoo, Donnie Cook. Donnie's been with us for 18 years serving the Minnesota Zoo, serving Minnesota. Pretty amazing person. He's been all over Minnesota with animals and doing education and conservation messaging throughout the state. Today he'd like to share just a couple animals in a short period of time with you. If I can bring Donnie up for a little presentation.
Welcome.
Excellent. I can do that. Now, one of the cool things that we do get to do for the zoo is show off animals to lots and lots of different people. And this is actually a Chuck Walla, things that people don't get to see normally. This guy comes from Southwest United States, comes from Arizona, New Mexico, places that are a lot warmer than here, places that I wouldn't like. I love the winter time. But this guy likes to live where it's nice and warm. He is total vegetarian. He eats nothing but fruit. He eats nothing but vegetables. And these guys, they actually have a really cool way to protect themselves. They have this black and brown scales that will protect itself to be camouflaged. And also, if something is chasing him, what he will do is he will dive into a crevice, dive into a crack, and then he will puff up his body. Mm. And puffing up that body will wedge him in there so nothing can pull him out. He's got this nice spiky tail that we can whack things with also. Here's another way he can protect himself. This guy's name is Chuck. Some people call him Wally. But he is about 6 years old, does a great job with us. And he is part of our programs both on-site and he goes off-site also. Excellent. I have one more little buddy for you guys to see. A little bit cuter, a little bit fuzzier. You get it?
Yeah.
All right, 1 second here. Because they are so fuzzy, because they are so cute, But the other reason that these guys are cool is that these guys are a hope. Because at one point, there was less than 100 of these guys left in the wild.
Oh, wow.
And that is because of this fur coat, because of the pet trade, because of other things like that. And through institutions like zoos, the Minnesota Zoo, other ones like that, we are now able to send money down, send people down, send funds down, send resources down to South America to where these guys are living. And now there are chinchillas where there never was before, or hasn't been for a long time. It's going to be a good one. No, these guys, they are cute. They're the softest animal in the whole world. If you look at our arm, look at our head, people, we have one hair coming out of each of the holes in our skin. These guys have 60 hairs coming out of each of the holes in the skin, which makes them super duper soft and gives them a very warm fur coat. Unlike us, when we get sweaty, when we get gross, we have to take a bath, take a shower. These guys should actually take a bath in dust, in volcanic dust. They'll roll around to get nice and clean. I know I would have gotten yelled at by mom, by dad, if I would have rolled around in the dirt when I was a kid, but it seems to work for these guys. They have so much fur that if they had took a bath like we did, get it? These guys would get all snarly, all tangly. So these animals, they just roll around in dirt, roll around in dust to get nice and clean. They are a member of the Ronin family, so as bad as it is, it's just a big fuzzy mouse. A beaver. A squirrel. But don't judge them by their other ones. These guys, they are nice and calm. They like to live in rocks. They like to live in mountains. They like to live in places where they can be nice and safe. They hop from rock to rock, and then they'll go to the caves to be nice and safe. Any questions? Anything you guys want to know about these two little friends that I brought today? Now, you can have these guys as pets. They do sell them in pet stores, but they don't make good pets. We used to get calls back in the day when we were bringing these animals on the road, probably once a month, about people trying to donate chinchillas that they bought to the zoo. Mm. And these guys, they are quite expensive to buy as a pet, and they are chewers. Think of them like a beaver. So these guys can chew through holes, or chew through walls, chew through telephone cables, chew through the cable TV. And this one is just sitting here nice and calm because we've handled him ever since he was teeny tiny. You know, you're not going to hurt him. You know, we're not going to do anything like that. But normally these guys, they are running, they are jumping, they are wiggling, trying to get away. So people who just see us handling these animals with such ease will think that their chinchilla at home is going to just come right from the pet store and do this. They also go to the bathroom about every 10 minutes.
Wow.
Which is a little bit unnerving, unheartening to some people.
Are you at 8 minutes?
What's that? There is a time limit for these animals. There is a time limit that we have reached in the past when we were at a school or somewhere else where. Rubbish. All right, I'm going back to my little van. Good deal. Thank you guys for letting me bring our animals to see you guys, and I hope you guys have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Connie.
Director Frawley.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the time to present to you today. Start off with just a little overview of the Minnesota Zoo. It is a unique state agency. A lot of people call us the new zoo, but we are a 44-year-old campus. We are the fifth largest zoo in the country by size, by space, so we are a big zoo. We have over 40,000 household members to the zoo, 1.3 million visitors. And our operating budget, a lot of people don't realize we receive one-third of our funding from the state. Two-thirds of the funding comes from us being a strong business model. So food, beverage, gate, events, our foundation, we have to work like a Main Street and provide two-thirds of our own funding. And so that's really important. You know, as we built our request for your consideration, we looked at a lot of cost drivers this year, and of course, with all the inflation and the increase in unprecedented times that we're living in, you know, applying that to our model and our needs is what we're trying to do with this budget model. You know, the zoo has, like I said, 485-acre campus, over 121 buildings. We have hundreds of vehicles, 10 miles of roads and pathways at the zoo. You know, our zoo, you know, has to feed and care for over 5,000 animals and supplies, as well as maintain a staffing and workforce, working with the bargain contract increases and all the enterprise IT increases that we've seen recently. So these are cost drivers that helped us build the model that we're going to share with you today. The recommendation from the, you know, in the governor's budget recommendation for the Minnesota Zoo this year, to address those increased cost drivers and the inflation, provides an increase to the zoo's operating budget of 2.87 in million in FY24 and 3.29 million in FY25. The recommendation also has one-time money, which I'll go over in a little bit, for public safety and security of $850,000. So that is the budget recommendations. A little background. You know, with that support, it'll allow us to maintain a world-class zoo with the highest quality of animal care. It'll allow us to continue the revenue generating that we need to perform to sustain our business model, especially the two-thirds that we need to raise ourselves to be sustainable. It'll address the rapidly rising costs that are outside of our control. And then a real focused area, which I highlighted here, it'll allow us to remain accessible to Minnesotans by keeping our prices reasonable and keeping our prices low. And one slide to focus on that. What we're seeing around the country or on the state is a lot of price increasing going all over the map. And in the zoo world, it's no different. We're seeing a lot of our colleagues. I called out a couple here, Indianapolis, Columbus, Henry Dorley. But across the map, we're seeing 20-30% increases in costs. You know, as a zoo, we wanted to build a model that remains accessible and not have that kind of big inflation happen here in Minnesota and at our zoo. And we wanted to remain accessible. So the budget recommendation supports an operating model that keeps the Minnesota Zoo accessible and just would only be subject to small increases as necessary. It would avoid that inflationary pricing. And our belief is once you start increasing prices, it's hard to go back. And so we really want to keep the zoo accessible moving forward. So that's a big part of our model this year. Back to the one-time requests. $850,000, this is a request that we proposed back in 2019 session, but it really is a 44-year-old campus. We're seeing a lot of needs. We need to improve our strong physical security. We need to modernize controls. We need to increase our emergency communications, radios, phone systems are all obsolete and failing. And obviously we need to monitor risks with the expanded security and cameras throughout the zoo. So we would really like to have this one-time support. We've actually put over $900,000 of our own investment into some of this. So this $850 is somewhat of a request to match what we've already been doing. So, Mr. Chair, committee members, you know, people are using the Minnesota Zoo more than ever. We appreciate your time today. Your zoo is serving, we are serving Minnesota in big ways. We're a recognized conservation leader. We work with partnerships with a lot of other agencies, a lot of other organizations throughout the state and the country. We're the state's largest environmental educator. We're committed to DEIA. We have free to explore programs. This year over 90,000 people came to the zoo for free if they qualify for general assistance. And we are a major economic driver for the state of Minnesota. So once again, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members for hearing it from the zoo today.
And Director Frawley, is Ms. Mosier or Ms. McGrath going to be testifying or they're just
No, I'm sorry available? To point out, they are both here today to support any questions that might be asked.
Members, any questions? Representative Edelson and then Representative Fisher.
Representative McGrath. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bierman, I'm a big fan of the zoo. Director, I'm just wondering, which city has the largest membership to the zoo?
You know
the answer. Come on. No.
Director Frawley. Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't have that specific thing. But I will take the opportunity to say that actually almost every county is represented, not just with attendance, with membership and our school serving. It's amazing how all counties actually benefit from the zoo. Of course, I'm going to say that. But we can get that detailed information for you if you'd like.
For the record, Representative Elson, do you have it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman and Director. I think it would be Dinah. But with that said, I think the whole state benefits from the Minnesota Zoo. And so I think, fear not, you guys also get to go. And I think, thank you for bringing the animals. Very supportive.
And Mr. Chair, may I just add, I was recently out a couple weeks ago at one of the fun events that the zoo provides, the adult night at the zoo. And I did take an unofficial poll of, just asking people where they were from. And I was just amazed at the cities across the state that people were at the zoo that evening for that event. And so it is a statewide operation.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to say thank you for the animals that came in earlier and presented to us. A question I have, I remember a couple of years ago when you were before committee, we were dealing with COVID, how it was taking a toll on your reserves and everything else. And just want to kind of get an idea of what's been happening in that area. How have your reserves built back? What are the cushions that you used to have that you may not have anymore? Just want to kind of get a gauge of how you folks ended up weathering as COVID came through in a financial way.
Yeah. Director Frawley.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for that question. The zoo has recovered quite well. It has taken us a lot longer to recover than anticipated. So we are still in recovery. Our numbers are still below some of the historical numbers. If you think of specifically in large events and some of the things that take planning and times, we still have not recovered on those parts. And we also are slowly to recover on the workforce build back that, from losing one third of our staff during the pandemic and the competition we have in the in workforce recruitment, especially with the trades and building services and so forth. So there are pockets around the zoo that are still lagging, and we're still working to build back to pre-COVID type levels and activity. Financially, overall, the zoo is recovering on a steady pace. Our membership is, like I said, over 40,000. During COVID, that had dropped down to like 20,000 members, almost in half, and that has built back. So we are seeing, some of those original milestones of pre-COVID numbers being hit, not completely, but Minnesotans love the zoo. It's a big outdoor zoo. I think that was part of the recovery, is the fact that we're such a big, safe outdoor space for families. So we're seeing that, I think, play into our favor. And, we are, this budget and the model we've built will help us continue to build out of that. But appreciate the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for the update on that. As I know that it was very tough during COVID and required a lot of dollars. Fortunately, we had the one-time dollars to help support it. But the important thing is, it sounds like the plans you're putting in place are taking impact and starting to build back to where it was. And appreciate the work you folks are doing out there. Thank you.
Representative Scrabble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should, Director, you should be on this side of the table per Representative Edelson's question. You handled that marvelously. I've been told that there are perhaps a special tour for the representatives. I don't know if it's an adult night representative or I don't know what adult night means, but do you guys have anything for us that we can tour your
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we've done those in the past. I've attended a few. Adult night was a little different. That's just adults coming in later in the evening, and they do have a few nice bars set up, and you can walk around and visit with neighbors, friends, and see the animals, and very nice time. Concerts in the summer, those are coming too, but I'll let Mr. Frawley comment on the prospects of a visit.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, we are in the planning stages for a day at the zoo that we'll invite all legislators and their families to come out to the zoo. I think we're working on the logistics of that right now. We are looking to return to the Capitol with cap animals here in the rotunda. So those are logistics are being worked on. And then, as always, I open the door up wide. It's your zoo. It's our zoo. If anybody would like to come to do a familiarization tour of the zoo and walk through and see some of the projects we're working on and where some of this funding will go, I'm personally always open for tours, and we like to do tours and show people the assets of the zoo. So that door is always open, but there are some formal invites coming your way.
All right. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let them leave. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Scraba, as a member of the Capital Investment Committee, will be making a tour stop over at the zoo, too. So keep it at that. So, Director, I see here that you have 18 FTEs. Is this currently, or with the request, is that going to be 18 additional FTEs?
Director Frawley.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't have the specifics in front of me. I would call on Ms. Mosier, our COO, Operating Officer for the Minnesota Zoo, to address that question, please.
Ms. Mosier, if you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Abigail Mosier. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Minnesota Zoo. And so I think the question was pertaining to the maintain current service levels proposal from the governor's budget, and those would be maintaining FTEs. So that's the resources needed to continue the current service levels under the governor's proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, am I getting it right then, Director, that currently, as the fifth largest zoo in the state, in the country, we only have 18 FTEs taking care of all of our assets then, or operating the zoo?
Mr. Chair, members, I really appreciate the question. We actually have, once we scale back all the way up to our kind of full scale from kind of recovering from COVID, we'll anticipate being back to typically about 250 FTEs. It is actually more like 350 headcount because we have a number of seasonal and part-time staff. So a lot of really hard-working individuals that do a lot of work for the Minnesota Zoo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just to, you know, build off of that, I think that this is, you know, a truly a great asset for the entire state, and knowing that they have 18 FTEs taking care of all of our, you know, infrastructure on the zoo and our, you know, animals and all of that, I think that this is great. And the work that they do on the research side, too, I think that's really crucial for us. And so I just want to say thank you to the Minnesota Zoo.
Any other questions? Probably I have a question on, you know, some of the groundbreaking like Skipperling work that was done with Dr. Rundquist, and just wondering how some of those grant drive funds are going. Are you still, you know, I know we've Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund has funded some things, but just wondering about the work that has been done that has been kind of groundbreaking around the country.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for Mr. Chair for that. The question regarding our conservation, as you know, the Minnesota Zoo is known for not just national and international conservation, but we've been really focusing here in Minnesota in our own ecosystems with turtles and bison and mussels, and specifically, I think the folders in front of you, you know, kind of highlight our focus on Dakota skippers and power sheik skipperling butterflies, which are critically endangered butterflies, almost on the verge of extinction here in the Midwest, formerly found all over Minnesota. That funding, I think the best, Mr. Chair, is stable but needs ongoing support. So I think, you know, as a lot of funding, it's something that has to be renewed, and the work is of great importance. And so I don't have the specifics of all the timing of some of the grants that we have currently funding the projects. There's a few that make up the entire budget. But we do have enough for the next few years to continue the work. We will be seeking and looking for more support to continue this work. I could reach out to Ms. Mosier if you could add anything more to that. But it's, you know, like I said, it's critical work. These are species that are listed as critically endangered. Well, they might actually see them go extinct on our watch is where they're at right now. So we're at the Minnesota Zoo hoping for the last remaining Dakota skipper butterflies in the world. And so thank you for that question. And I can give you probably a better and more thorough update. I can have that sent to you from some of our staff, our conservation staff.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Director Frawley, for all your work. It's good to see you again. Last time we spoke, I think you told me about the work that you're doing to make sure the zoo is accessible for low-income Minnesotans. Can you, and so I'm really happy to see your commitment to ticket prices. Can you talk to me a little, can you remind me about ways that low-income Minnesotans can access the zoo? And then I have some follow-ups.
Director Frawley.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the question. One of the first things, you know, arriving to the zoo 7 years ago, access was obviously a key importance of mine, and I think our entire team. One of the things we've discovered is that one of the best things we could do for access, and most zoos are cultural institutions in the history of a lot of places, it would be like a free Tuesday or a free Wednesday, which is not really accessible friendly for most families. So we shifted away from that, those historic practices, and said the state's already doing a good job identifying people who need assistance. And anybody who qualifies now for general assistance with the state of Minnesota, we created a program called Free to Explore, where if you show any proof of general assistance, you now come to the Minnesota Zoo for free. So families are free if they are qualifying for general assistance. Since implementing that program 6 years ago, we are averaging 100,000 people for free coming to the Minnesota Zoo. So I like to say the Minnesota Zoo is a free zoo to those who need it to be free. We're continuing to increase that by looking at 2x poverty. One of our goals there is to work with corporate Minnesota and try to underwrite days so that even if somebody doesn't qualify for general assistance but has minimum wage jobs, it still might be tough to come to the zoo. So we're working and leaning on corporate Minnesota. A good example is Dakota Electric. Underwrites a day at the zoo, or just bring your electric bill and you get into the zoo for free. On that day, we had over 9,000 people come to the zoo on Dakota Electric Day. So we're looking around for partners to really work on those 2x poverty level families that are out there. So there's more we need to do. I think we need to promote the Free to Explore program more widely throughout Minnesota, which I think is something we're going to be working on. I'm not sure everybody knows about that program as much as they should. So I think we're going to be increasing our communication about that Free to Explore program. And we're always open to any other ideas that people have on how we can make the zoo more accessible. But those programs are growing at a good rate, so we feel good about that.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's a great update. I think that number has grown since the last time we chatted. I also have a follow-up question. I asked this question last year. When are you getting a new red panda?
Mr. Chair.
Director Frawley.
Committee members, really important question. I hear the concern. We actually have a master plan at the Minnesota Zoo that we are planning different exhibits. We are, and part of one of those master plan projects is a new red panda exhibit. There's a few other priorities ahead of the red panda exhibit, some major infrastructure that we want to fix, but I can assure you that that is on the master plan agenda. Thank you for the question.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just today met with someone from the University of Minnesota Veterinary School, and I understand that there's a partnership there. So just going off the continued partnership, I'm curious if you can expound on that a little bit. Thank you.
Director Frawley.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we pride ourselves in partnerships, obviously. I think that we've always had a strong relationship with the University of Minnesota on many fronts. Right now Dr. Mulgard, who heads up the veterinary medicine program at the University of Minnesota, and we have been meeting. It's still kind of quiet, closed doors, but this is not closed doors, but I think she'd be comfortable with us sharing that we're always looking at how we can share resources and how we can share expertise and how we can recruit vet students to Minnesota to come to those programs and also have them exposed to the work that we do at the Minnesota Zoo. An exciting project that one of our next big capital projects that's in our bonding request this and has been for a while is we would like to build a world-class new vet hospital at the Minnesota Zoo. Our hospital is over 47 years old, and so we're looking to build a new vet hospital. And we wouldn't embark on a project like that without talking to our colleagues here in the state of Minnesota about the vet needs throughout the state. We'd want to build that hospital to serve Minnesota, not just the Minnesota Zoo. And I think that's why we would like to talk to our partners and at the University of Minnesota to see how it could benefit both of us.
Representative Bierman, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I would just say come out to the zoo as soon as you can, explore, see all the things going on. It's so enjoyable, and I guarantee you will feel better after a trip out to the zoo and spending some time with the animals and the amazing staff out there. So thank you for your consideration.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on House File 462?
as amended. I renew my motion that House File 462 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Next up is a presentation of the governor's budget recommendation for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We have 15 minutes for presentations and 10 minutes for questions. Director Jashke, Assistant Director Fish. Welcome.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. John Jashke, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources. And with me is Andrea Fish, Assistant Director, and she's going to load this thing up so we can zoom through it. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to provide an overview earlier, so we'll probably focus just on the governor's recommendation general fund change items. They're also, of course, in the governor's budget book. There are a number of things related to the Clean Water Fund, which will be presented to Representative Lilly's committee at some point down the road. So with that, I will begin. And this is the one slide that's from the previous presentation, which is, you know, our projects, our programs, our funding, you know, is ultimately delivered through local governments. We focus on the private lands of Minnesota, and we do that through local organizations, local governments specifically, soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, counties, cities, townships, and of course we also work with the private sector organizations either directly or indirectly in those same program responsibilities. This is just a statutory list of where most of those things are found. I won't go through the details here, but at some point down the road, there may be some connection back to these statutory provisions with some of the funding roles that the governor has. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Fish to go through, this is the overview here of all of the items in the governor's recommendations, and she will go through those in a little bit more detail, and then I'll wrap it up.
Director Fish, welcome. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Andrea Fish. I'm also here with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. As Executive Director Jashke mentioned, I'm going to go over and highlight our climate change items that are before you today. Want to start with the Soil Health Practices Program. So we are seeking funding for Bowser's new Soil Health Practices Program that would establish a voluntary and locally driven soil health program. Soil health programs really can take a number of approaches to reducing erosion in the soil as well as regulating water and sediment runoff. By keeping the soil as minimally disturbed as possible, including no-till practices, and continuous cover crops so that there are continuous roots in the ground that can help hold the soil in place. The Soil Health Practices funding request does include an opportunity for a federal match as well that we want to make sure that we have the ability to take advantage of and continue to use toward our best practices. Our proposal for the Accelerated Water Storage Program allows us to address continuing large waterfall events in the state of Minnesota as our climate continues to change. This program will help us to acquire, design, and construct projects that control water volume and rate. And this is another one that is voluntary and locally led. I tend to think of these water storage structures, the retention structures and basins when considering accelerated water storage program, but this also includes wetland restoration and floodplain restoration opportunities as well. Moving on to the Habitat Enhancement Landscape Program, we did discuss one component of this at length, so I will start with the other two. The first one being the HELP Habitat Enhancement Landscape Program for existing natural areas, conservation plantings, and open spaces. This does offer a cost share program, technical guidance, and other facilitation so that soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, watershed management organization, and counties can begin to plant these areas of pollinator beneficial gardens and larger plantings. The habitat-friendly utilities component of the program builds off of a previous habitat-friendly solar program that provides financial and technical assistance for the successful establishment of native vegetation and pollinator-friendly areas along solar wind pipeline areas and electrical transmission corridors, really taking advantage of the spaces that are provided by those utilities. And finally, of course, there is the Lawns to Legumes program that we had previously brought before this committee. This is a great program that is targeted toward residential lawns and community spaces and neighborhoods. We've had over 17,000 applications for this program for individual garden plots, pollinator gardens, flowering trees, and shrubs. And about 12,000 of those applications are still waiting additional funding so that we can keep moving with this. It's been a very popular program. And again, I know that we brought this forward before with Representative Tabke's bill. But as always, if you have questions, that's what we're here for today. And the last climate item I wanted to go over are three items related to our conservation easements. Bowser has been very successful with conservation easements over the years. One item that we wanted to make sure that we are able to address is grasslands and working lands. Typically, conservation easements have been geared toward retiring croplands, and this would allow us to take advantage of either existing prairies to protect them or to take advantage of other working grasslands so that we can continue to invest in easements on those types of properties. We are also seeking an ability to engage in additional easements for peatlands. Peatlands being a remarkable opportunity in Minnesota. We have the most peatlands of any of the lower 48 states. Most of any other than Alaska, in fact. Peatlands themselves are not only fantastic for carbon sequestration, but when they are disturbed, they emit large amounts of carbon and other greenhouse gases. So looking to be able to purchase easements for peatlands. And then with our existing easements, wanting to be able to inspect aging easement infrastructure, make repairs, make improvements, and make sure that they are resilient to our changing climate in Minnesota and addressing any additional needs there. I will turn it back to Executive Director Jaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, again, and as Ms. Fish indicated, you know, some of these things are going to also have a policy provision, and I thank you for the introduction of House 1828. I think that was introduced today, which has got a number of those pieces in there to make these things work well together. This slide just indicates, as was mentioned, the federal funding opportunities, and this indicates through this Federal Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed mid-year in 2022, what they did in that bill, well, many things, but one of the things that was included in there was an acceleration of the climate beneficial practices that come through the USDA conservation programs. And you can see these are national numbers, of course, in ultimately billions. But if you look at just the scale change from the current year 22 or now 23, there's a slight uptick. But then if you look at the years coming in the next several here, these numbers are going to double, triple, or even sometimes more than that. And so what we need in this case is state money to go get these federal dollars to bring them to Minnesota, because they've already been appropriated at the federal level. And so the details of how exactly those pathways will be established is not entirely certain yet. So we appreciate some flexibility in consideration of the appropriation rider language around these recommendations to make sure we can make the most of these opportunities. And as we learn more about this, we'll make sure we keep you informed about that along the way. There are also a couple of other general fund items that are in the categories that are in our base, I guess you could call it, the Natural Resources Block Grant funding, which it goes to counties for their responsibilities and requirements, I guess you could describe it as, for the Wetland Conservation Act, the Shoreland Management Act, and the water management authorities that they have through state statutes, a couple of which I cited earlier. This funding for this program has been flat for 20 years, so this is mostly just an inflationary adjustment to keep up with the cost of that responsibility the counties have. And then the second item here is a tribal liaison position that we would establish to accommodate the statutory changes that were made a year and a half ago to do the consultation with the tribal governments. We've already started some of that, but the full consultation takes a full-time effort. This again shows that natural resources block grant funding, you can see it actually decreased and then hasn't increased, you know, over that period of time. And these are actual dollars, so you can imagine they're much less in terms of buying power as that 15 or 20 year period has now gone by. And then this one is not, Mr. Chairman, in the recommendations that come through this committee, but we wanted to highlight it because it's an important consideration for all the things that we talked about earlier, and that is the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. The governor's got a recommendation for a Soil and Water Conservation District aid payment mechanism to provide state funding in a predictable and straightforward fashion to those organizations that don't have any local mechanism to generate revenue. So this would be the state foundation that would be supporting their work, which the state relies on to a great extent. And so that would be through the tax bill, Mr. Chairman. With that, we will take any questions that you may have or any other information we can provide.
Members, any questions? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. So on page 12, the additional Bowser related changes, see that there's no change for grant making to tribes and NGOs. Can you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, yes, so these are two provisions that are policy adjustments that are now considered fiscal because they would allow us to make grants to those organizations if appropriations were directed our way to do that, right? So it just makes the policy line up with the potential appropriations. The easement stewardship fund is similar in that it allows us to use the existing funding in a slightly more flexible fashion, and the details of those will be in, actually they're in House File 1828 as well, so you can read the details there. We'd be happy to present those details either now or later.
President Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I think it would be good to know what are the policy changes specifically to the grant making to tribes and NGOs, just so that we know. I don't think that there's been language that's out there publicly, and so if you could share with us specifically what are the policy changes, just so that we know.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, I can just give you two examples. One is, you know, we have in one instance with a prior appropriation for the Clean Water Fund, a direction to enter into grant agreements with tribal governments and NGOs. There's actually a direction to do that. We, you know, of course the appropriation says we can do it, so we can do it, but we would think that it would be important to have standing authority to do that in the statute. So that's really the one main piece of it there. We'd be happy to talk with you about those other details either today or when that bill that I just mentioned, House File 1828 or something like it, is before this body.
On that point, you know, I think before when there's been question of contracting out, is it a task that could not be done by state employees? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if there are grants to NGOs, are those NGOs substituting for work that could be done or has been done by state employees, or is it a new task or a different task?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, a couple of examples. Actually, one, you know, was mentioned along the legumes. We contracted with Metro Bloom, which is a nonprofit that has a great deal of expertise in this area, and it worked very, very well for them to, in a much more cost-effective manner, organize these workshops, make sure people were trained to do the work that they were being provided funding for. Another example, and it's been a direct appropriation for several years, is to the Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa, and they are, you know, they employ youth to do projects, and so they are a nonprofit, but they're set up to do a very cost-effective support mechanism to our programs and our projects, and of course they're training people along the way, you know, as well as an additional benefit. So there's two examples of NGOs that we work with per statutory appropriations.
Members, any questions? Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Chair. Director Jaski, could we just talk for a little bit about soil and water conservation districts and their funding, what that looks like this session?
Director Jaski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Heisman, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, a number of our programs, you know, rely on their readiness to do the work that the state is asking them to do. Some of those things are statutorily directed already in either the 103C statute or many others. And there's quite a long list, and we can provide you with that list if you'd like to see something more explicit. As I mentioned earlier, the governor's recommendation is to provide the state funding for their work through this aid payment mechanism that would come through the tax bill.
Representative Heinzman.
Mr. Chair, this, I guess, would be more a question for this committee and for you. Will we be having an opportunity to talk about that here?
That's a local government aid request. It's going to be in the tax bill. It's Representative Ryer, and I think that's where it's going to be heard. Any other questions? The question on the Federal Inflation Reduction Act, because I think yesterday USDA announced another $19.5 billion. I'm losing track of federal dollars that are out there or on the runway or already being deployed. And is that money coming through you to the Soil and Water Districts, or is it coming to the federal government, to the NGOs? How does it actually get implemented?
Yeah, Mr. It's a very good question, and there's lots of parts to that bill. But what was announced yesterday is basically what you see in front of you. They were just announcing a 2023 process for those dollars, which, you know, are fairly modest increases. But they're going to, as you see here, you know, beginning in fiscal year 2024, ramp up dramatically. These four rows here are federal acronyms, you know, Environmental Quality Incentive Program, the Conservation Stewardship Program. These are the first two, and each of those use federal contracts to deliver money, but there's also mechanisms called contribution agreements where they can make an agreement with a state to put our money together to do those types of activities. And they have a list of activities that are going to be eligible for these funds, which I can share with you at some point if you want those details. The next two on the list here, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, this is a grant program that we actually have to bring some other funding to the federal government to get their half, so to speak. So it's a grant program that would come to the state and then pass through. The first two are direct payments to landowners or producers that we may need to supplement with either some additional financial assistance or technical assistance to those, so those dollars can be ready to be applied in Minnesota. And the last one is the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program, which is easement, so you're acquiring a property interest. And that program requires that an entity, state or an NGO, could and needs to be the entity to hold the easement. So fortunately in Minnesota, we have a Reinvest in Minnesota program, which is statutorily established and is functioning, that could do this very well. So we have to work out agreements with, in this case, the Natural Resources Conservation Service of USDA to figure out how to do these things beginning in federal fiscal year 2024 is our aim.
And previously this committee last week approved incentives for CRP. Mm-hmm. With these programs, are we going to need appropriations to incentivize them or to achieve them?
Mr. Chair, probably more the latter, to achieve them. Now, they're depending on, for example, on easements, I would say we may need some money to make them financially applicable in Minnesota, you know, because the federal payment rates for easements are capped at $4,000 per acre. And of course, we know that the costs of the land in many cases exceeds that. In the case of the other contract programs, it's going to be more likely that we would need money to achieve them as opposed to supplement the payments the feds are making.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. I forgot earlier, I had wanted to ask Director Jaski about tribal interactions and also, you know, what that looks like. I know that that's happening, but it's not something that we hear talked about, and I think it's fairly important that we discuss that.
Director Jaski.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Heisman, we're the two areas that we've been working on currently, I guess, is one is on the watershed management issues, because of course watersheds, you know, cover all of the land that is within a watershed. That includes public land, private land, includes local governments, it includes tribal nations too. So that's one of the things that we're spending time on with them, is how their role and how their interests can be accommodated or pursued or enhanced in that watershed approach. The second one is much more technical, as we have to make sure, for example, when we do rulemaking and we're going through this very not so exciting process on rulemaking for the wetland conservation, all we're doing is folding in the statutory changes that have accumulated over several years into the rule, because local governments use that rule as the guidebook for how to carry out the program. We have to make sure we consult with them on rulemaking as well. So that's a couple of examples, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Chair. Director to that item there, is that something that rises to the level of needing a full-time position to make sure that we're fulfilling that obligation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, we aren't at this point doing it at that level. There are some other things that we need to pay attention to, including easements, for example, you know, easements within tribal reservation boundaries, things like that, that are going to take more attention than we've given them already. So at some point, this will continue to grow. The issues will continue to be important and even more important. So I expect that we will need a full-time person very soon.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you. Next up is Metropolitan Council. Director Barajas, Metropolitan Council, Governor's budget recommendation. Welcome to the committee, and good to see you again. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm Lisa Barajas. I'm the Executive Director of the Community Development Division at the Metropolitan Council, and I'm here today to present the Governor's environmental budget recommendations, similar to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. These are recommendations coming out of the State Climate Action Framework as it relates to the Metropolitan Council, in addition to some additional work that we do. So just a quick overview of the council. We were established by the legislature in 1967. We're a 17-member policymaking board. Not me. I am staff there. But the chair and our policymakers make up the board, which and are responsible for guiding the strategic growth of the metro area for the last 50 years. Officials and citizens and residents of the region share their expertise with the council by serving on numerous advisory committees that the council has as part of our work. We are the primary regional planning agency for the seven county metro area, ensuring that development occurs in an orderly manner as we're directed to by statute. We operate the largest housing authority in the state of Minnesota when it comes to Section 8 vouchers and offer assistance to more than 7,000 families in the metro area. The council partners with park agencies to develop and maintain a regional park system with 55 regional parks. Our environmental services division is nationally renowned for operating a system of wastewater treatment plants, ensuring that our lakes and rivers are clean. And the council also owns and operates Metro Transit, which is one of the leading transit systems in the nation. And I'm sure you've heard a lot about our work across. This is just how we're organized. And the statutory authorities associated with them. I know that the numbers are very hard to read and small, but generally you can find most of the work and direction of the council in Chapter 473. Not all of Chapter 473 pertains to us, however, but you will also see some additional direction and guidance for us in other chapters like 103 and 116 as well, but the bulk of our direction is here in 473. So today I wanted to talk about budget recommendations as it relates to the work of our regional park system, as well as some work that we do coordinating technical assistance for local governments in the region. So I'm going to start off first on our parks related budget proposals. And just as an overview, our regional park system, if you haven't visited, it is nationally renowned. Many people, including ourselves, refer to our regional parks as the state parks of the metro region. And to be clear, we're not funding local baseball diamonds or soccer fields, but rather these are large acreage opportunities to experience the outdoors and natures within the region with a planned system of trails to connect all of those elements to one another. Our system is made up of 45 regional parks, 12 park reserves, 8 special recreation features like the Como Zoo and Conservatory, and 55 regional trails, which count more than 400 miles of biking and riding opportunities across the region. In total, the Metro Regional Park System is almost 55,000 acres of parkland open to all Minnesotans. And we work closely with the 10 regional parks implementing agencies to increase the equitable use of the regional parks and trail system. State support helps make the regional park system a true gateway to Minnesota's amazing outdoor opportunities, and it's something that we coordinate closely with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources state park system and trails and fishing access piers and the variety of opportunities that the DNR is responsible for. Total operational expenditures for the regional system exceed $120 million in 2021. The total annual visitor use of the Metro Regional System reached an all-time high in 2021 as well, with nearly 65 million visits. The value of the regional park system, as many of you are familiar with, has only grown during the pandemic, which of course increases to the wear and tear on the system. So for reference, this is a map of the metro area that is showing the geography of the 10 regional parks implementing agencies, and they're named on the left of the slide here. The green marking on this map, which some of you are familiar with, I know, represents both where all of our existing regional parks, park reserves, are open to the public, as well as where we have trails in place, both planned and open to the public. There are a lot more trails and parks that are planned for the region to continue to grow as our region continues to grow and meet the outdoor demands of our growing population. But I can't show you that map on a slide today because it is not easy to read, but happy to follow up if you have any interest in that as well. The Metropolitan Council serves as the fiscal agent for this funding source and does not receive a direct allocation of any of the funds that we're discussing today. All operations and maintenance funds are dispersed to the 10 implementing agencies, and I'll dig into that a bit more as when I get into that slide. The first budget recommendation I'd like to talk about is a proposal that we're calling Modernizing Regional Parks and Trails. And the governor's budget recommends $12 million in one-time general fund appropriation to be matched with $8 million in Metropolitan Council funds. This investment would provide $20 million directly to the 10 regional park implementing agencies that own and operate the regional park system, and really focusing on renewing facilities and habitats that have been increasingly impacted by climate-related events and growing usage, especially during the pandemic and carrying forward. We are, as the picture illustrates here, increasingly seeing flooding on a number of our trails and parks, especially in the legacy portions of our system. Our newer portions of the system are able to accommodate and plan for and see those and plan around those, but the older portions of our system are now seeing increasing accessibility issues when we are seeing flooding and standing water and inland flooding, I should mention as well. This isn't river flooding that we're seeing, but rather overland standing water, much like what we're experiencing today with and yesterday with a rainfall on top of our snow and frozen ground. We see that in summer months for extended periods of time as well. So addressing some of these issues that we're experiencing across the system, as well as increasing accessibility for those who have a disability and increasing mobility access across the regional system as well, as well as creating up-to-date features that are reliable, available, and on a regular basis, predictable for meeting the region's recreational needs. This particular initiative really fits with the state climate action framework under the Climate Smart Natural and Working Lands and Resilient Communities, really focusing on conserving and enhancing biodiversity. Many folks don't think about this, but the large landscape that the regional parks and park reserves hold a significant amount of regional or habitat within the region, and that habitat also needs to be managed and maintained. So focusing on some of those efforts using land management practices that enhance climate resilience and promoting the benefits of natural lands and climate adaptation. Given the continuing growth and urbanization of the region, our regional parks and trails, especially the corridors, hold a particular value in ecosystem service benefits that can help ameliorate some of the negative impacts like urban heat island that we experience in the metro area. The second proposal I'd like to turn to is an increase on the operations and maintenance funding. The governor is recommending increasing that O&M funding by $2.5 million in general funds for each fiscal year in years 24 and 25. That total allocation that would come to $12.49 million per year. This funding is distributed by formula, as is noted on the slide here, to each of the 10 regional parks implementing agencies, and is related to other statutory responsibility that the council has for tracking the expenditures on an annual basis that each implementing agency makes related to operations and maintenance of the regional system. So this is how those numbers break out. In general fund dollars, you see the base funding at $2.54 million with a proposed increase of $2.5 million on the right-hand side, and then lottery and lieu funding as part of the base there at $7.45 million. That would bring the total to $12.49 million on an annual basis. Operations and maintenance funding pays for a lot of different things, but really related to programming, engaging with the public, maintaining the system, as shown on some of these slides. That includes things like vehicle and trail maintenance, grooming for our winter activities as well, for skiing and other winter sport activities, habitat restoration, tree trimming, and other similar activities, as you see on the lower right, and of course snow plowing. And what you see in the upper right are even being responsive to some of the increasing demands that during COVID that we were experiencing in the system for making space on our regional trails and having to even close some of the nearby roadways in order to accommodate that increased usage. That all actually costs money. It looks simple, but it does cost money, and those items add up as part of that. Finally, I want to turn to not a parks item, but one of the efforts that we are responsible for at the council is supporting local governments in their planning and in their local decision making through support that we provide through data analysis and technical assistance and tools like this one that I'll be speaking about in just a moment. These tools are meant to help local governments address issues that they might otherwise not be able to address on their own due to capacities, restraints that they may have within their own staff. Not everybody has a planning staff or engineers on staff or the capacity to pull all sorts of data from a variety of sources and to do that analysis. And that's one of the roles that the council continues to play and has played, is taking on some of that work and providing those tools and resources for local governments. So this recommendation from the governor is a $5 million general fund appropriation to create a web-based planning tool for metro area communities and watersheds to use to protect local infrastructure from the adverse effects of extreme weather events and climate change. You see some of the events that we have on the slide here today, but one of this tool really is meant to really improve the data availability and modeling that capabilities to support climate smart communities, creating green spaces, helping to support local governments in their creation of community green spaces and protecting water resources and responding to increasing and persistent water on the landscape, and then establishing resilient buildings, infrastructure, and businesses as they're considering and planning for the future. Again, this is an effort that is directly aligned with the climate action framework at the state level. And I should also note that the council recently adopted its own climate action work plan that guides our activities and our operations related to our own emissions, but also related to our partnerships within the region and how we support others in the region in achieving those same goals. This climate tool directly addresses those multiple initiatives. And in addition to the 2020 State Water Plan, which I didn't mention previously. More specifically, and there's a lot more data and detail that goes into this, the goal of this project is for the council to leverage region-wide data sets and resources to provide local stakeholders with a resource to help prioritize funding to build and retrofit infrastructure to be resilient to more frequent and intense weather patterns. This project will include capacity building for local organizations through trainings and engagements with Green Step Cities, the Minnesota Green Corps, the University of Minnesota Extension, and the University of Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. So I thank you for your time today. I'm happy to take any questions.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director, for your presentation. One of the things I noticed that part of the funding you receive is addressing water sustainability. And the question I have is, it feels like there's a little bit of a disconnect of how sometimes things are being done at the council and they way they work with the local communities. And where I'm coming from is, while we're taking a look at regional water supply planning, I know that in the Northeast Metro, we got clobbered when all of a sudden the DNR said we might have to limit water over there, but it doesn't seem like there's anything that was taken in advance in anybody's plans. Everybody's panicking. So I was wondering, what are the requirements for local communities to have backup plans if their current supply isn't available? And that also ties into, when I take a look at like Lake Hummel as an example out there, they're not able to get enough water to support the housing units, and as a result, they're going to have to stop building housing units out there and not meet the guidelines that the Met Council has set. So what needs to be done to change this? Is there something from our side? Is there something from your side? I know that you've got technical assistance groups to help facilitate things, but it feels like there's a disconnect, and they aren't getting it out there, and as a result, communities don't seem to have a backup if their main system goes out.
Director Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. That is certainly a challenge that we are, actually, we're just discussing this morning about next steps on how we would address that. And I would welcome Judy Sventek to join me on the conversation from our water supply unit. Our work at the council in water supply planning is at a much higher regional level, and our partners at the Department of Natural Resources are actually the ones responsible for reviewing and approving water supply plans. We work very closely and try to coordinate those efforts, especially as part of the regional planning process, so that we can ensure that that we don't run into these issues. I don't think we were anticipating the White Bear Lake issue as part of that, nor the lawsuit associated with that. And when I say we globally around the region with agency partners as part of this process. What our next steps will be are continue to be coordinating and supporting that work with local governments on what those opportunities are for looking at where water supply plans could be in place of what they're currently doing, coordinating with the DNR on how we can continue to build in assurities into the planning process so that we're working together on a shared set of understanding and building, because it is important to us that we have predictability in that work as well, because we're building our own capital programs under the same assumptions that local governments and others are working on. So we need to continue to work on that. It is a challenge that we know that needs to be addressed, and we are committed to addressing that.
The testifier wanted to introduce themselves.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Judy Sventek. I'm the manager of the Water Resources Group at Metropolitan Council. And the thing I'd really like to add is that, you know, this is a joint effort that we're working with the DNR and others on, and it's like, you know, we're doing the high level planning. We are looking right now at talking about what needs to be in any updates of the local water supply plans in conjunction with the comprehensive planning process, and how we can strengthen that and make sure that we are kind of the best of our ability avoiding these issues in the future. Of course, this is one that kind of snuck up on us, and you know, we're working with the permitting agencies and the DNR has a lot of responsibility in approving those local water supply plans, but you know, we're trying to provide some more technical assistance and direction around this in the future.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the details you've provided. The things that kind of leave out there a little bit as well, what the DNR did last year was a little bit of surprise. We've known this issue's been out there as the court case that went through and was done almost 10 years ago now. And what it comes back to me is that communities are supposed to have, what are they supposed to do for water supply when their main one goes out? And I'll use the example of Minneapolis. If something were to happen in Minneapolis, they got 3 days supply of water. So what is their backup plan? And that's the type of thing I don't hear. I don't hear, you know, something being put in, okay, if this fails, what do you do next? And it feels like you get a crisis like this and we're all kind of panicking at the same time. So I'm wondering, you know, putting a little bit to the Met Council, is what is going to be done to strengthen that, so that if a crisis hits in one, here's what we start rolling to instead of everybody sitting around and panicking for months.
Director Brajas, and sure. Just I want to know, we have three other questions coming. So, Director Brajas.
Mr. Chair, I would note in the case of the communities around the north and east, around the White Bear Lake area, that they still have water access. But I appreciate your point about what I think is more of a response to more of a continuities of operations issue, and that is something that the local water suppliers are responsible for, and maybe you could speak to that a little bit, Judy.
Sure, Mr. Chair, committee members. I was going to just add the point that the local water supply plans do require communities to address what their backup is, and obviously there's some work that needs to be done in that area. And this is one of the things we'll be looking at when we're starting our conversations now with the DNR and the health department about how we can change these and the requirements and see what more we can do in this area.
Representative Edelson, then Representative Jordan, then Representative Jacob, and then Representative Lee.
There's a lot of representatives in there, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director, for this. I guess I'm new to environment, so some of you might have heard this already, but can you just tell me a little bit more? I was reading a UN report about climate smart cities and, you know, nationally what this looks like, but what does it look like for Minnesota when you're talking about this planning? And then also just one more thing, in terms of the regional parks and the 10 and the disabilities, making sure that they're accessible for disabilities, wondering if you don't have to give it to me now, but if you have any list of how we're doing that or ideas of what they're thinking, that would be really helpful to follow up with me after, but climate smart cities.
Sure. Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. It's a great question. Climate smart cities. There's a lot of work that I know local governments are leading, especially some of our larger local governments who've received outside funding, grants from large national organizations to support their climate smart working. What we're really looking at, I think, and especially in the work that we've done on our own, is looking at our own vulnerability and our infrastructure, our roads, our sewers, but in particular at the council, the infrastructure that we own. And we've done a large analysis of that in our current climate vulnerability assessment as stewards of significant public infrastructure, and also wanting to ensure that we are ensuring that the services that we're providing are actually continuing to be reliable and available, even in spite of changes that we might be seeing or flooding or persistent flooding that we might be experiencing. So our first step in that was doing that own assessment on the sewers, all of the buildings we own, which are a lot of buildings, and including the houses that we owned as part of a housing authority, but just which portions of our systems are more likely to be affected on a regular basis or not. And having learned from that and sharing that with our local government partners in the region, they also are like, hey, that actually might be useful for us, and using some of that data. But where we want to go further in supporting that is making that data more granular, more useful, and building in some modeling as part of that as well, rather than at this point where we're at is sort of a 1.0 of a kind of a screening tool of sorts. So moving forward and thinking about, when we think about climate smart, thinking about where can we predict where things are likely to be impacted on a regular basis and then make adjustments today. And some of our regional parks funding, the modernizing piece, is about adjusting to where we're already being impacted today. So adapting to changes on the landscape, predicting where we might continue to see changes, and planning around those and avoiding those where possible. And think as we're thinking to 2050 in our next regional development guide, really thinking about, well, what do we really think of as being actually developable and no longer developable given our new climate realities that we're seeing on the landscape. So we're thinking about that infrastructure piece, and of course there's the other elements. That was just on adaptation. I don't have time to get into mitigation, but that certainly is, you know, reducing our emissions as a part of that as well.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Director Barajas, for your presentation. 65 million visits is a number that makes me really proud and excited that so many of my constituents, and myself included, are utilizing and enjoying our parks. They're one of the things that, you know, made me move to Minnesota. And I hear that from a lot of my neighbors. But I think the flip side of that is that our parks are being loved to death. They are starting to feel a little bit like a baby blanket, where you can tell there's a lot of love, but there's a lot of holes. And so I know the state is supposed to pay for, some of the maintenance and ongoing like operation costs. Can you tell me what that number is, and then what that means in dollars?
Director Barajas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jordan, the statute indicates that due to kind of the non-local nature of the regional parks, that the state would be responsible for picking up 40% of the total operations and maintenance expenditures that the regional implementing agencies are putting in place. 40% of 120 million. Somewhere $50 million, I think. I won't do the math that well in my head. Would be about 40% of that.
Mr. Chair, Director Barajas, and so are we meeting that obligation to these 65 million visitors?
Director Barajas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, the state has never met the 40% item in statute.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So the governor's recommendation of a $5 million general fund appropriation to create a web-based planning tool for metro area communities, and then it says and watersheds. Is that exclusively for metro areas, or is that statewide? How is that broke down?
Director Barajas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, because the council operates within a seven-county metro area, we are only proposing this for the metro area. The other difficulty is that across the state, while it could be modeled across the state, the level of data availability is different and not as strong as it is in the metro area, but we're happy to work with state partners on potentially looking at what a statewide model could look like.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Jacob.
That's it, thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, so in the agency profile, says that the majority of the operating funds from the Met Council came from charges for service, for example, wastewater fees. And so can you tell us how much of your operating budget is actually from wastewater fees?
Director Barajas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I cannot speak to how much of our operating budget is. Wastewater fees support Environmental Services Division in particular in operating that. I'm in the Community Development Division. I do not receive in my division. Our division's activities are not supported by wastewater fees, where a variety of other things, our housing authority, for example, is federal through housing and urban development. But I can get you the budget book afterward to share that with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. I appreciate that, knowing that this is not within your jurisdiction, but I think it will be good for us to know how the Met Council is assessing wastewater rates among the different communities within the seven county metro area, and specifically how did the Met Council account for certain communities or parts of communities that may have significantly more poverty. Mm-hmm. And how do we ensure that whether you're a small segment of a community like, you know, my district in North Minneapolis and the city of Minneapolis, that when you, the Met Council is going about assessing these rates, that poverty is considered? I think that this is really crucial for some of the work that we do in this community, Mr. Chair, regarding clean water and wastewater treatment. And so I just wanted to put it on your radar. If we could get that information, that'd be great.
Director Brown.
Mr. Chair, we're happy to follow up with our total budget information, but what I can tell you today is that the rates that the council provides is the same rate across the board. We don't have a variation in rates.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation today, Director. Representative Jordan's question relative to the dollars coming into your subject area prompts a comment that I've made in a previous committee, so you're familiar with what I'm suggesting, but just for the benefit of everybody at the table, I am hoping that there can be some agreement as to what might be considered in a renewal of the ENRTF. 60% of the dollars, and Mr. Chair, I know you know this, 60% of the dollars collected in lottery sales goes to the general fund. And as we're considering what we might do in this subject area, parks and trails, I'm suggesting, and I have letters that I'm that I have prepared ready to go out to the governor's office and anybody else that I think might be able to come together on this. I'm suggesting that rather than dropping those dollars directly into the general fund, that we might consider redirecting it, and I'm open to ideas as what the breakdown might be between the three parks and trails systems around the state. Clearly, our parks and trails do have some serious infrastructure needs and ongoing maintenance needs, and it's not being covered.
and our obligation to the people of Minnesota is not being met, to your point, Representative Jordan. So I hope that this is something that can gain some traction. I'm not sure the reasons why. I continue to ask every time I have folks in my office from agencies and in committee, with Representative Lilly's committee, where I talked about this publicly for the first time. And, you know, quite honestly, I haven't really heard a real good reason why not. And rather than increasing fees, which we're hearing constantly is a barrier to people who want to access Minnesota's parks, why don't we look at something that is ongoing, potentially, I'm just going to assume that the renewal could be an additional 25 years, and we address this going forward. So that's my pitch, and I hope that something might come of it.
Well, I might take a shot at that. I think the question is, and when the constitutional amendment was passed, is the supplement versus supplant. So are these things that have been in law for 50 years a responsibility of state government that should be handled by state government, or should, we're putting something in the Constitution, should it be special? And if we are not willing to invest in what we're supposed to be doing under law, that's a problem for us, not the voters voting on a constitutional amendment. And if we do something for a constitution to ask the voters for that special allocation, then it should be for something special, not the maintenance and not the routine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Hopefully we can dialogue on this a little bit, because as I think you and I both know, if the voters decided that they wanted those changes to Minnesota's constitution, the issue of supply or supplant would be decided by that constitutional amendment. And maybe the voters want to see $50 million annually, at least looking at today's number, approximately $50 million a year dropping into this subject area. Then that would, of course, change the conversation. The Constitution would be addressing that. And in the conversations I've had with constituents and from numerous folks even here in the area that are stopping by and are concerned about their parks and trails, we're hearing about it today, there seems to be a lot of support for the idea, and the concern over supply and supplanting is maybe not as it has been characterized. Maybe people would like to see the Constitution change to allow for some of these real needs to be met.
Kind of beyond your scope, Director Barajas, I think.
Outside of my pay grade, thank you.
I do have a question, though, on the wastewater. And so we have had, I believe, in this committee and other committees, presentations of average monthly costs of water per community. And we have had that often comparison given for a water bill compared to an average across the metropolitan area. And we have, when we have asked for the data on that, it is unavailable. So as the Metropolitan Council, can you get us the average water bill per community within the 7-county metro area? Doesn't have to be right now, but at some point, through a survey or some other means of getting an average water bill, residential, per month, per community,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, representatives, I know our staff have looked at this in the past, and then there are some issues with how different communities bill. Some bill like on every 3 months, some bill actually monthly, and so there's some change there. But I certainly we can follow up with our team and see what that might look like. I don't know, Judy, if you're familiar with any recent activity.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm not aware of anything recent, and I just want to clarify. So you want the average residential bill for wastewater, not the bill for drinking water.
The wastewater.
For wastewater. Sorry. And I can add that, so we charge a rate, and of course, every community can charge an additional rate on that, which is why it's not an easy answer, but yes.
And we are running out of time, and we have the Science Museum, so I'd like to bring them up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Allison Bowen, President and CEO of the Science Museum, and John Severson, Director of Government Relations. And I'd like to get done here in about 10 minutes, if that's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Allison Rebel Brown, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today. I'm honored to serve as President and CEO of the Science Museum of Minnesota. I'm joined by John Severson, Director of Government Relations, and in the audience is Robert Doty, Chief Financial Officer of the Science Museum. It's also my honor to lead this vital and beloved institution, the Science Museum. And this past month, we celebrated our 116th anniversary serving our great state's residents. While located along the Mississippi River in downtown St. Paul, not too far from her, it is much more than its physical location. It's a powerful symbol for Minnesota, demonstrating and sparking visitors and students across the state and what our world can be when we use science to tackle our most complex challenges. And the museum is an inspiration, inspiring generation of Minnesotans to see themselves in STEM, so science, technology, engineering, and math, and help new prepare a workforce of today and tomorrow. So whether your family has lived here for thousands of years, immigrated here a century ago, as mine did, or arrived yesterday, the museum and all it has to offer is here for you across generations. However, Mr. Chair and members, we're here to tell you we're still in recover mode as Minnesota's Science Museum. We appreciate and celebrate the state's long-standing support, and each by name we come to the Capitol excited to share the impact of our science education equity initiatives. Unfortunately, due to the longer than anticipated road to recovery from the pandemic, I'm here to share that many portions of this work are at risk due to significant budgetary constraints as we rebuild our visitor base and earned revenue streams. So as we plan for the future and work to regain the financial health of our institution, an institution that celebrated 35 years of consecutive balanced budgets before the pandemic, we face difficult decisions that will inevitably change the very nature of our organization. We're deeply grateful for Governor Waltz's budget recommendations of $1.2 million for fiscal year 24 and $1.26 million in fiscal year 25. That's about less than 4% of our operating budget. And those are the first increases we've received in a decade. However, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the museum respectfully requested consideration of even more significant appropriation to see us through this critical short-term financial challenge we are facing. With this additional support, the board and leadership of the museum will have the breathing room needed to thoughtfully adjust our business operations. I'm here today to ask for the committee's support for a one-time appropriation to retire the remaining debt on our beautiful St. Paul facility that was opened in 1999. We have carried and paid down this debt for almost 25 years on our new building. A one-time pay down of $12.3 million would result in nearly $1.4 million in positive cash flow each year by removing the museum's annual debt service. The $12.3 million figure consists of $10.1 million in what I'll call mortgage debt, a $200,000 liability swap we fixed our debt, and $2 million line of credit, which we've used to mitigate the impacts of the pandemic. The impact of this transformational investment cannot be understated on both the museum's short and long-term financial health, and I request and encourage your support of this investment in one of Minnesota's greatest assets. Mr. Chair, members, supporting K through 12 education throughout Minnesota is one of the Science Museum's core commitments that we won't pull back from. The museum is building science literacy and addressing opportunity gaps by transforming how science is taught across the state so that everyone, girls, youth of color, trans, and youth from families with limited resources see themselves as scientists, even if they don't become one. Our world needs science and science education now more than ever. The Science Museum is a statewide asset. Last year, we were able to reach 70 of 87 counties with over 90,
91,000 engagements through our school-focused programs. We're working to get back to all 87 counties that we did for 7 years in a row before the pandemic. Remarkably, over the past 15 years, science museum education programs have impacted over 1.6 million students and 128,000 educators. We need your help to continue this record of excellence. We have equally important programs in science and equity that I can't cover today, due to time today. I'm happy to come back to talk to you about those anytime you want. I do want to note that over 15% of our visitors come through our access programs with free or greatly reduced prices. And we also implemented our Indigenous Access Program this year that provides free access and parking for anyone who identifies as Indigenous. Lastly, I invite all of you to visit the museum this spring to enjoy time with fantastic experience at the museum with your family and your friends. So, Mr. Chair and members, we appreciate the opportunity to testify before the committee today. We shared highlights on the depth and the breadth of our work and the vital role we play in preparing and inspiring young minds across the state. We are grateful for the generous support we receive in service to Minnesotans and ask for your continued support as you ride out the rough waters presented by the lasting effects of the great national disruption. Thank you for consideration of our request and your continued partnership with the Science Museum of Minnesota. And we are happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your presentation today. I know the Science Museum does good work, but I was extremely disappointed in the Science Museum based on the way you handled your staff unionizing. It is hard to take budget requests seriously when the Science Museum was able to find money for to employ an anti-union law firm when staff was organizing. I'm glad these workers do have a voice on the job. I would encourage you to embrace a unionized workforce. But it was very disappointing to see that and hear that from my constituents who work at the Science Museum and felt and had worked through the pandemic and had seen the work you'd done to pinch pennies, but then also saw that the Science Museum was able to come up with money to retain legal services to fight staff unionization. So I hope you can keep that in mind as you push for things like equity, as you push for things like science experiment, to make sure you're taking care of your staff, and that is part of your budget, right? That is part of your budgeting as well. So thank you for the work you do, but I need you to do better, and I need you, that's extremely hard for me to hear that you need money, that it has been hard, but to know that there was money found for busting a staff union. Mr. Chair, and that's what I'll say about that.
President Brown.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan, thank you, and we will certainly take your words to heart. And we've taken a lot through the unionization to heart, and we've learned a lot through that process. And our employees did vote to unionize, and as we told them throughout the whole process, that we will respect whatever the employees decide to do. And it was a 60-40 vote to unionization, and we look forward to working with the union and moving forward through a journey of healing and reflection and working together as an organization. So thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Edelson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, it's been a long day, three committees. I just want to say how magical that I believe the Science Museum is in the state of Minnesota. I remember going as a child, and my children have stories about when they go, and we see a science museum in every city or state we go into, and it's a huge asset for our state. So I just want to say that I'm very, very supportive, and thank you for all the work you do. We make some of the top list for science museums, so that's good news.
Members, any other questions? Seeing none, we are adjourned.